I'm Katie James, and this is the Midwives Cauldron Podcast. Each episode, I'm joined by my incredible co-host, Dr. Rachel Reed. Listen in as we hubble, bubble, toil and trouble our way through aspects of womanhood, midwifery, birth and lactation. So go on, subscribe now, and hear us on your favourite podcast host. This episode is all about assessment of labour as we interview Dr. Claire Davidson. Dr. Claire is a midwife, academic and feminist. Claire is passionate about promoting and supporting physiological birth and working with women so that they can be empowered in their birth choices. Claire combines these passions by working as an independent midwife, providing holistic continuity of care to women, and as an academic, teaching and hoping to inspire the next generation of midwives. We delve into those questions you want to know. What is the cervix saying in labour? How can we properly assess labour progress? And we look at a midwife's way of knowing and using our other senses. We ask, how can midwives and health professionals trust birth and support women if they're not being given the skills to support physiological birth progress and use their intuition? And we even ask, how many contractions should there be for an effective labour? How quickly should the cervix dilate? How often should a vaginal examination occur? And when can we assess that labour has actually started? Find out lots in this episode of The Cauldron. So tie up your shoelaces, plug in your headphones, and come with us on a ride into the world of assessing labour progress. Good morning, good afternoon, and welcome, Claire, to The Cauldron. It is an absolute blooming pleasure to have you with us. Thank you very much.
Thank you for asking me. It feels a bit strange actually being in The Cauldron at last after having you in my ear holes.
Yeah, coming in your ear holes. Oh, I shouldn't say that. That's always been in my mind. It's from Peter Kay or something. Sorry.
Oh, I'm flustered already.
I do.
I have to take my scarf off.
Okay.
That's a good start anyway.
Oh, no, I'm crying. Oh, oh my Jesus. Okay. Right. On that note. Oh, Jesus. Okay. Deep breaths. Good. Claire, following on from that, can you introduce yourself for our audience and tell us a little bit about what you're doing, why we've brought you on, and where you're at in your midwifery career?
Did you notice that Kate, you went all Davy Stop there?
Did I? Should I? Where you're at?
So, Claire, tell us all about yourself.
Jesus, I've actually got that. It's like a permanent accent. It's my second personality. Jesus.
All right, sorry, I'll stop interrupting. Please answer all the right. question.
Please answer the question within 30 seconds.
Okay. All right. So I am a midwife and I am an academic. And I live in Western Australia. I'm originally from the UK. And I am a midwife in private practice. That's what we call it over here. So basically an independent midwife. So I still work clinically, but I also work as an academic for a university in Australia.
Fantastic.
So, yeah. So I'm very, very passionate about physiological birth, which is probably why you asked me on. And also, of course, I know Rachel quite well. So, you know, we're doing a couple of, we've got very similar interests, shall we say.
Mm-hmm. Claire's my evil twin.
Apparently.
God, I've got two of you.
Although I don't know which one's evil. Well. Like, when we turn up to conferences, we actually have to message each other with photographs of what we're wearing to make sure we don't turn up wearing the same thing.
Really?
Because it has happened numerous times.
Oh, my God.
So, that you know, eventually when we're old ladies and we share our house with our servants, we'll just have the same wardrobe, won't we? We've decided it'll just be for what we call our posh nighties. So we can flounce around. That. But yeah, we have very similar taste in clothing.
So do you wear a scrunchie?
No, I've drawn the line. There's some things that I just
look at her.
Know.
Look, show your head. Look what you've just done.
I'm wearing my yoga clothes.
Are we doing
I have
yoga?
A scrunchie that came free with my yoga pants. Look, stop shaming me.
I'm not shaming you, but are you actually doing yoga? Are you just doing that thing when people wear active wear for the whole day?
Oh, you mean
it's
that
almost
thing
like
where?
Doing the real thing. That thing. Have you done yoga today?
I have done yoga today. I did 20 minutes.
Good
about
job. Well
2 done. Hours ago.
Good job. Well done.
We digress.
Anyway, because it's all about me.
Yes.
Yes, I don't know what else to say at the moment because I'm distracted by the scrunchie.
Sorry. That was a real segue, wasn't it? Claire, how did you get into academia from being a private practicing midwife?
God, by accident, definitely not, was not on the plan at all. Mm-hmm. I just, it goes back to when I was doing my mid. So I did nursing first, and then I did my mid as a mature age student. And then the joke is I found out I was clever, which was quite exciting because I didn't realize I was clever before then and got excellent marks and then was asked to do a Master of Philosophy. So I was approached by Professor Sarah Bayes, who I joke about has given me, you know, so many opportunities. So either a lover or a hater at certain times, depending on how the day is going. Mm-hmm. But she was running the research high degree by distinction. Is that what it's called? No, higher.
High degree by research.
That's it.
So clever that you don't even know HDR. The name of the thing that you did.
That's got to stay in now, Rachel. You're in debt.
Anyway, she asked me if I would be interested in doing a degree, an extra degree, a master's, which was not on the radar at all, which I did. So I did my first HDR was a Master of Philosophy in Why Women Chose Privately Practicing Midwives. So when I'm from the UK, in the UK, you know, people don't, well, in the day, I suppose nowadays they've got a little bit more that you do find more women choosing independent midwives, but most women just went to the local midwife and had their baby through that. And then I was living in Australia and I couldn't really understand at the time. I soon found out very quickly, and particularly when I started working within the system, why women would choose, you know, to pay a lot of money to have their own midwife. So that was the focus of my master's. And then from that, I got some sessional work at a university and started writing some curriculum. And then I applied for a job and bizarrely got it, which was a bit of a shock. And then from there ended up, so that was back in 2013. And then I've worked in academia since then. So teaching and doing a little bit of research. Oh, so then obviously I did my master's and then thought, you know, that wasn't enough punishment. So I thought, you know, why not do a PhD, which again was, you know, something that was unheard of for me. Now I'm the first person in my family to go to university. And, you know, it wasn't something that people like me did as such. But I loved it. I actually loved studying. I loved learning. I was super interested. I love storytelling, which, of course, is the kind of research that I do. And then, you know, one of my absolute, one of my massive interests is history. So, you know, and also why are we in such a mess in Australia with midwifery? I just couldn't understand why midwifery wasn't really recognised as a separate profession and why nobody really seemed to know what midwives were or, you know, how it just wasn't like the UK that, you know, everyone presumed they'd have a midwife. You know, the majority of women expect to have their babies in hospital. Most of them expect a doctor to oversee that care. Midwives were called nurses. So I decided to look into the history. And some of it was inspired by wanting to look at the older history. So looking at colonial history, so not the Aboriginal history, because we've got to recognise that, you know, Aboriginal women have been having babies with Aboriginal midwives for 60,000 years. And you know, that's not my story to tell, as much as I would love that story to be told and just to be aware of it. My particular interest was looking at how the institutionalized midwifery had ended up in the way it was. And also because I wanted to So that was the first part of it. And then I also felt that I'd learned so much by the stories of my mentors. So I was lucky enough to mentor into private practice with an amazing midwife called Teresa Clifford, who actually was one of the founding midwives of the Community Midwifery Program in Western Australia, which is one of the very few government-funded home birth programs that we have in Australia. And, you know, I wanted to tell those stories as well. So I wanted to talk to the midwives that were, you know, independent midwives. So that's how I kind of ended up doing this PhD. It was called Looking Back, Moving Forward. And it was a history and discussion of privately practicing midwives, we called it in Australia. But that's what midwives all were, you know. So I think we forget that. It's like it's a new fancy thing, but actually midwives were always privately practicing midwives in our westernized world. And it was only when birth moved to the hospital that we got this new employed midwife, which is relatively new in our history. So, you know, it was quite funny when, you know, that's the history I looked at, but it's only really when we started with registration and then birth moved to the hospital that we ended up with these different new midwives, which is what, you know, what the majority of midwives, so people think about when they look at midwifery today. So, yeah.
We'll be right back.
I just wanted to pop into your luggles and tell you about my brand spanking new podcast, The Feeding Couch. This podcast ain't just designed with pregnant women or new parents in mind, but also for all of us working in the space of birth work. This is the podcast where I hand the mic over to a different mom, dad, parent, or even grandparent to take us on their feeding journey. Every story matters. It's often through hearing others' experiences where we find our own inner knowledge, strength, and courage. Listen in to hear the stories told of triumph, challenge, heartwarming, tear-jerking, fist-pumping, and how we each deal with our venture into this new world emotionally, socially, and physically. Whether you're a student, a newbie midwife, doula, lactation exam prepper, or just hungry for more knowledge, these stories will also give you a backstage pass to the global lactation clinic. Whether you're pregnant and seeking information or supporting those on their journey, I can't wait to see you on the couch with me soon. Oh, and a little favour, your reviews on Apple Podcasts mean the world. They're like magic beans that help spread the podcast out for those who need to hear it. Let's make this something amazing together. And where are you at with your PhD?
Oh, no, I finished my PhD in 2019. So all finished. Sorry, do you not know my name, Katie? It's Dr. Claire to you.
I'm gonna cut that
right, Rachel? Now then.
Didn't quite put two and two together there.
I think I was getting above my station.
It could have been something else. Yeah, did something else.
Yeah, exactly. So it still feels like I'm a fake anyway. I still get overexcited if somebody calls me doctor, because they're not for the likes of me, but apparently it is. So I used to say I was really mean, actually. I remember before I'd say to Rachel, well, if you can do it, I can do it, because, you know, people like you get it. Like normal people, you know. But yeah, so I finished it in 2019. And funnily from that, when I was doing it, people used to go, you know, what are you doing your PhD on? And I'd go that. And they go, well, what for? What's the point? Kind of thing. Which, you know, because, you know, everyone wants to do, you know, numbers and, you know, tools and things, you know. But my whole concept is it's like we're being on the hamster wheel. We're just constantly going round and round and round. And until if we look back and see where we went wrong, then we can't change the future. So that was my big thing from going from that. And then from that, the Australian College of Midwives invited me to be part of their amazing work that they're doing looking at the history of midwifery. And there's a little plug here. There's a great website that we've developed over the last 18 months. And actually one of my absolute heroes, Nikki Leap, Professor Nikki Leap, was the one who invited me. So that was me. I was like, well, you know, that's why I did my PhD, so that one day Nikki Leap would send me an email asking me to be part of something she was doing. So I get to hang out with Nikki Leap and Leslie Barclay, who was the first professor of midwifery in Australia. So they're on one of the committees that I'm on. So it was all worth it, all the pains for that.
So we have got you on here to talk about your latest research that I am a really slack co-researcher on. Because we started this when years ago, and then we had COVID, and then I left academia, and then I started a business.
And I sent you an email, didn't I, recently saying, Rachel, you know, finger out, you know, as if you've not got enough balls to juggle, let's have another one, thanks. But yeah, we did this amazing research, and we are going to finish the analysis and get this out there, because we're looking at research about how we assess progress in labor, because the way we do it is rubbish and it doesn't work and it's all made up. And even midwives who work in the system that, you know, use the standardized way that, you know, the medicalized system says that to assess progress in labor, we have to stick our fingers in women's vaginas, feel their cervixes and see how dilated it is. And that's how we know if a woman's progressing in labor, and we know it's supposed to happen within a certain time frame. And if it doesn't do that, then the woman isn't progressing. And we know that's not true. We know that's absolutely not true. You know, all the research is made up. All the research that's done on cervical, doing vaginal examinations and checking cervixes is inconclusive. It basically says, you know, does it work? Doesn't really work. We know, you know, it's just rubbish, actually. So we decided, well, I decided that I'd like to do some research on how midwives actually did that. So we looked at health professionals, and we actually interviewed a couple of doctors, but mainly midwives. And we just did it within Western Australia and in Queensland, because obviously that's where Rachel and I are based. And we just asked that question to, you know, midwives and doctors, how do you assess progress in labour? And they, apart from a couple of them, did not use vaginal examinations as their primary way of assessing progress in labour at all. That was amazing, isn't it?
Really? That surprises me in terms of how the system works.
So we did look at physiological birth. So we were looking at, you know, the idea of in a physiological birth, how you would assess progress in labour. Most of the people we interviewed did work in a home birth setting, but a lot of them had also worked within the system. So as in the mainstream system, the hospitals. So they talked about, well, you know, in particular, there was basically two streams of the way they spoke, because they also spoke about, well, in the system, this happens, but that's not really how we assess it. So they might do vaginal examinations, but they're actually only doing that to tick the box, but they're actually assessing them in a different way. Because they might do an examination, for example, and go, oh, the woman, you know, is 6 centimetres for a number. But no, she's not really doing anything. So it doesn't matter what her cervix is saying. And the midwives were telling us this. It doesn't really matter if it's 6 centimetres or 9 centimetres or 2 centimetres. It depends on all the other things that they're watching and looking at, which it's almost like this, you know, this secret that we all know, but nobody actually says it. You know, we've all been there. We've all been there in the hospital when a midwife comes into the staff room or the office or whatever and goes, oh, she's cracking on, and then writes 3 centimetres. Like, so how does she know? She's 3 centimetres, so she's not going to have a baby for 7 hours, according to, you know, the protocols, you know. So how do you know she's cracking on? What does that mean? You know, or the woman that's, you know, 8 centimetres, but you go, well, she's not going to have a baby anytime soon because she just doesn't look like she's ready to have a baby. So, you know, it's a really interesting way. And it's that, you know, there's lots of things in the literature about midwives and nurses, what we call doing good by stealth, isn't there? There's that classic thing that, you know, midwives will say and do things because they're supposed to do it to meet the criteria, but that's actually not what they're doing, you know. And I think that's what happens in most of the ways that we assess progress in labor. We say, you know, we're doing something, but that's not actually how we're assessing. So, you know, the midwives talk about, you know, they basically only do vaginal examinations if they're able to. So if they're working within a system that allows them not to do, you know, 4-hourly vaginal examinations, then they don't do them at all because they don't see the point. So how, you know, so, but they still must be doing something, wasn't they? Because they're actually, you know, providing midwifery care to these women. So what do they do? Mm-hmm. Well, they're observing behaviors, they're observing, you know, physical movements, they're observing smells, they're using all these other ways of knowing to, you know, figure out if the woman's in labor or not, and how she's progressing. And it doesn't really go with time, it doesn't really go with vaginal examination. So basically it's not linear, it's not something you can particularly map, but they just know. So go figure. How does that work? It's amazing. No, because it would be like, we've done it, and I'm very much filling my hands. We joke about, well, it'd be, you know, circular, up and down, round and about. It just, you can't map it. And this is the problem, because we want something. We all want something to say, yes, a woman will do this. She will always, you know, at 4 centimeters, she will be in active labor, and then she will progress with 3 to 4 or even 4 to 5, whatever number of contractions per 10 minutes. And then when she's done that, you know, within, you know, however many hours, she will be ready to push, and then she will start pushing and push her baby out within a time period. Well, that's what everyone wants, because, you know, how else would you staff a hospital? How else would you know how many staff to be on? You know, it's not about the woman. It's actually about providing that midwifery care. Because previously, when we didn't work in the hospitals, it didn't matter either. They didn't do vaginal examinations. The midwives didn't assess women that way. They just called when it was time for the baby to be born. So how did they know? Well, they just knew. Like, it's this thing.
And vaginal examinations were something that a midwife would do if she thought there was a complication happening. So it was like a intervention for complications. It wasn't a tool of assessing progress.
And that's what the midwives in our study, that's what they said. Well, I might do one if I'm concerned, or if there's, you know, there's something doesn't feel right for the woman, or, you know, there's just, she's not looking like she's progressing, and I want more information. So that's what the vaginal examination was for. It wasn't even then about progress. It was about, can I get some more information from this vaginal examination? For example, they really talked about looking at baby's position and things like that. So thinking about heads being, you know, off to one side, or, you know, something funky going on with that, rather than how many centimeters a woman was dilated. Because again, that wasn't necessarily the biggest thing that they were looking at when they were assessing. You know, and it wasn't done just because, it was done because they were concerned that something wasn't progressing. So yeah, it was definitely not eye-opening, really, because like I say, it's almost like it's the best kept secret, because we all know this. But it's so interesting when you think about how midwives and doctors are so unconfident in those other skills in some ways, that they don't know what to do unless they do a vaginal examination. And I talk about this when I use my sister as an example. My sister, when she was having her second baby, she was a nurse and lived on the grounds of our hospital. All right. So she'd had a, you know, normal birth with her first and second baby. She wanted a water birth and, you know, was planning on having, well, she was considering having a home birth, but at the hospital, at the birth center, literally across the car park, they're this beautiful big bath. So, you know, I'm going to go and birth in this, you know, beautiful thing. So calls my mum to come and look after her other son. When she gets there, my mum takes one look at her and thinks, I don't know if she's going to get to the hospital, because she looks like she's having a baby anytime now. My mum, who's not a midwife. Then, you know, she's like, no, I'm bloody having that water birth. I'm going to get to the hospital. So she manages very slowly and with the support of her partner to get to the hospital. Her partner's thinking, I think we're going to have the baby in the car park, who's not a midwife. She gets to the hospital. And she's already called them, remember, to say that she wants this water birth. So she gets there. They haven't run the water because they need to assess her first to see if she's in labor. So the bath's not running. So by this time, she's literally, in her words, telling me, I feel like I'm holding the baby in, because, you know, her shoulders are up to her ears, because she feels like, you know, she's really advanced in labor. So, of course, she can't get in the water until she's had a vaginal examination, because, you know, how will we know if she's in labor? So then she's told she has to have a vaginal examination, which she does, because she wants to get in the water. So then what happens? The midwife says, oh, you're only 4 centimeters. So, you know, you're not really having your baby anytime soon. So In the next minute, my sister has literally climbed off the bed because she's freaking out now. One, how can she possibly be only 4 centimetres? Because her body is telling her she's about to have a baby. Secondly, like, she's just lost it. She starts to lose it. She's backed herself into a corner. Next minute, she feels like she has her bowels open. So she's like, something's terribly wrong because, like, what's happening? I just don't know what's happening. And she's totally freaking out. So then the midwife says to her, you know, you need to get on the bed because by this time everyone's... Then her partner and the midwife get her back on the bed because obviously, you know, something, you know, they need to do that because she's losing the plot. She's all upset. Then she's saying, you know, she's obviously having a baby right there and then, but nobody believes her. She feels like something's terribly wrong. She's trying not to push because, you know, and then the midwife does another vaginal examination and says, oh, yes. Yeah, you can push. You're having your baby. And of course, he's born minutes later. So that's my example that from my sister's story. Those are the kind of stories that I hear. So my sister knew she was having a baby, knew she was progressing well. My mum knew she was progressing well. And her partner knew without doing any vaginal examinations. The midwife in the hospital had to do 2 vaginal examinations. One, when she did the first one, with a woman who was obviously about to have a baby. Because the cervix said 4 centimetres, she couldn't have a baby. Within seconds, within minutes, she had a baby. That was extremely traumatizing for my sister. That birth was terrible. I used to say to her, I wish you'd just stayed home because my mum would have been a better midwife, who's a panicker. So, but she still would have been a better midwife because she recognized all the signs. So that, you know, drawing out stories, the kind of thing that inspires me to do this research, because I think so many midwives don't trust women, don't trust birth, and don't trust their own skills because they're not taught them anymore. And, you know, it's really, really tricky because if that's the only tool you're given, like, how on earth, you know, can you support women?
But they also don't get the chance to develop those skills, the unspoken ones, the intuitive kind of knowing with all of your senses. If you are not ever seeing physiological birth progress without interventions and vaginal examinations, then how can you develop that? How can you learn?
Absolutely. And it's true, because that's, if all you ever see it going one horribly wrong and women not being able to do it on their own, then how could you ever how could you ever trust birth? You know, and in Australia, like, we just had our figures, our latest stats, and, you know, we've got less than 50% of women go into labor spontaneously. So that's not the amount that actually birth spontaneously. You know, and I say very openly that I believe the only way you can have a spontaneous vaginal birth, or pretty much be, not guaranteed, because there's no guarantees in birth, but, you know, to be able to go into labor on your own, whether that is at 42 weeks with a big enough baby, you know, that might be over 4 kilos, and to birth wherever you want with whoever you want, your best chance of doing that is working with a private midwife. And that's so sad, you know. It's just, you know, that's pretty much the only way that you're going to be able to have that, because, you know, society is not set up to support women or birth. And the midwives, like you say, haven't got the skills anymore. We see it all the time in our practice when we, you know, have new midwives that want to come and work with us. And, you know, they miss the cues because they're not looking for them, and they're not in tune with the women because, you know, it doesn't look like the textbook says. It doesn't look like what you see in hospital. Like, you hardly ever see women contract 4 in 10 at home or in a physiological birth. Very rarely would see that. And if you did, I'd be like thinking, that feels like a bit too much. But, you know, what we do in hospital, we go, oh, you've got to do it in this certain order. And when you get later on in labor, we expect you to be contracting 4 in 10 because that's the only way the baby's going to come out. Whereas we usually see women.
Have we got to this point?
Well, because we've medicalized birth, haven't we? We've just, you know, we've taken women out of the home. You know, we've put them in an unfamiliar place, giving them strangers to look after them and try and make them all conform to this pattern. And if they don't, we intervene. So, you know, and that's why, again, lots of births go wrong in hospital, because, you know, just all those things. So you can be a perfectly normal, healthy woman that walks into a hospital and, you know, your best intentions, you still may well, you know, struggle to give birth physiologically because our bodies aren't designed to do it with strangers. in an unfamiliar environment.
Absolutely.
You know, and hospitals, I'm not bagging hospitals. You know, we have hospitals. They're amazing. We've got doctors that we need, but only for 10 to 15% of women. I mean, that's what the World Health Organization says, isn't it? That 10 to 15% of women will need, you know, that extra or a cesarean. And after that, there is, you know, no benefits to mums or babies. And we've got a 38% cesarean rate and less than 50% of women going into labour on their own. I mean, it's just unfathomable, really. But we just keep perpetuating.
But then again, it's kind of, yeah, but it's not. If you look at the roots and the her story of birth, is that it, what we're seeing at the moment, as you've previously said, is not birth that's set up around women and communities. It's set up around complex organizations that require women to come in and only be on the ward for X amount of time because that's all you're costed for, that staffing needs to be allocated appropriately. So you've got really system-centered practices that most women don't fit into. And then if they don't fit into, they've kind of forced like a machine through the machine in order to make the machine function effectively. So it's no wonder I always say, you know, when people say it's appalling, the rates of physiological birth in hospitals, I actually think it's amazing. Yep. I think it's amazing that any woman, when set with those time parameters in an environment that she doesn't know, with people that she doesn't know, with somebody putting their fingers in it every 4 hours, actually manages to switch off, move into that liminal phase of labor and get that baby out without interventions. I think it's, you know, that's more amazing.
And I think what's really interesting as well, isn't it, is about when labor starts. That's one of the big things that you see in the research. And again, when I was looking at the research, you know, prior, you know, doing the literature review before we went into our study, it's like, it's more of the research is actually focused on, you know, we've decided we know how to assess progress in labor. That's obviously vaginal examinations, because, you know, there's no other way. But it's about how you, so what the research focus has been on for the medical system is how we assess when labor starts. And then everyone got overexcited, because if you remember the American obstetric, there was a research study that came out and they went, actually, it used to be 4, but now we're saying it's 6. And then everyone was really excited because they went, great, well, that means that more women are going to have normal births or physiological births, but totally missing the point again. And that's, again, it's because we're trying to keep women out of the hospital. We don't want you to come to hospital too early. We want you to be in what we call active labor, so that there's more chance of you having a normal birth. But the fact is, you know, they're not going to have a normal birth because of all the things that you just said. So it's all about, you know, it's like almost the gatekeeper, isn't it? It's like, we'll let you in. You've got to come to hospital because it's the really safe place to have your baby. It's the only safe place to have your baby. But you can only come once you're a certain, you know, amount in labor, because otherwise we might actually make it worse for you. So you need to stay home as long as you can. And it's like that oxymoron, is it just doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
And the only people that can assess you are the people that are in the hospital, because it requires fingers in your vagina. So.
But if you said right back at the beginning that the research that supports all of this is rubbish and there isn't research to support the progresses or the progress charts that we look for, the vaginal examinations, what I want to know is, how are we at this point? Is it purely that we're able to, someone up there was able to say, this is really inconclusive. However, we are a hospital. We have to function like the machine and we need X, Y, Z in this amount of time. And we're just going to ignore the research and we're going to go ahead and train midwives, obstetric nurses and obstetricians that this is the path that women should be having, vaginal examinations, progress and amount of contractions.
Well, it all goes back to the philosophy of, you know, women. And like Rachel was saying, it's all back to the historical stuff as well, because we actually, most of what medicine knows about women is actually from cadavers anyway. So it's from dead people, basically. So it's that whole body is a machine, you know, it has to work a certain way. Most of it is about, you know, the, you know, basically manually helping. You know, when you look at, like, I did pull from my stats, I did pull out Friedman's study and just try and look at, you know, what that was, you know. And when a lot of the, again, when birth moved to the hospital, the only way women had babies was, you know, if they basically sedated women and pulled them out. That's what they did for most of the early hospital things. So they don't believe, you know, for, even though it's only really 100 years, just over 100 years since we really started messing it up in the hospital, even though obviously before that, you've got the whole women are absolutely a subclass of men. So they're not that important. None of the research has been done about women, you know, women are, you know, birth was hidden anyway. It was women's business. So nobody really knew what happened anyway. And then when we did see what happened, as in the medical system saw what happened, it didn't work properly because why would it? Because of all this other stuff we've talked about. And then the men came in and fixed it for us, which was great. Thank you very much. And so it's not, it's, I don't think it comes from, it's not malicious. It's just that they just don't believe women can have babies. Mm-hmm. Like they just really don't believe that without help because, you know.
Well, and what they're learning from, I'm out in my course, online course, I actually follow the diagrams that were initially done on cadavers, like dead women of babies in torsos, to learn about birth. And then I follow them through the textbooks throughout time. And it's the same picture of a woman on her back, a torso with a baby coming upwards to determine, you know, the birth process. The only difference is that it goes from an obvious cadaver where you can see the severed legs to line drawings, then into kind of digital representations, and then into 3D moving parts. But it's this, it's based on the same thing. So when we're taught in universities as midwives, obstetricians, this is how we're taught. We're taught from textbooks that haven't changed. And textbooks were only written initially by men, and medical men, because midwives, it was an oral tradition, so they handed it down through apprenticeships and and between each other. It wasn't written. So this is how we're still learning about birth today. It's still there. It's just in, you know, we've got models now in the labs that are in exactly the same as the torsos that they learned from. So it's no wonder that, you know, the intention isn't bad. They truly believe that this is how you assess labor progress. And it doesn't matter that there's lots of research showing that that's not accurate and that most women don't fit the patterns and that the patterns are incorrect and cervixes don't open like that. It's not going to change until the culture changes, because it's not about individuals going, I'm going to mess this up by creating this guideline. They're just basing the guidelines on past guidelines, and it just keeps perpetuating itself.
And also, what else are you going to do? This is the thing. What else are you going to do? Go, all right, you're all just going to do it erratically, you know, because that's what one of the research studies I read talked about erratic cervixes, because they do. Like some, like I just gave you the story of my sister, 4 centimeters, 10 minutes later had a baby, you know, my own birth, you know, thank you. I wish I'd had that kind of birth. You know, I'll stick around 6 centimeters for my first for, you know, a couple of days. Thank you very much. Until, you know, he decided to come. You know, it doesn't work like that. So how do we, you know, how can we change it? Well, we have to change the whole system, because it's not set up to work like that. So you can't have women birthing in hospitals on labor and birth suites staffed by employed midwives if birth doesn't work the way we want it to work. Because, you know,
that's really depressing.
It's, well,
and we can't research on those women. So one of the other problems that we found when we did the literature review was the research is primarily done on women who are having 4-hourly vaginal examinations in hospital settings and who are being augmented if they don't fit the timeframes.
Yeah.
So we actually need to get right outside of that and start, you know, like we were talking to Ellie about, we actually need to start looking at what happens when we're not doing things to women, when physiology unfolds, because we need to learn physiology before we can start overlaying anything else onto that, you know. And midwives have been assessing labor since the beginning of time and still do it. And even in a hospital setting, they're still doing it intuitively. As Claire said, you know, we're still doing that. They're just not valuing it.
Yeah.
And they're not writing it down on notes. They're just saying it in the staff room to the next midwife who's, you know, coming on to shift of that woman's cracking on.
Which,
you know,
really actually is one of my other things. And I upset somebody recently saying this. And, you know, and actually one of the podcasts that you guys upset somebody and made somebody cry, which wasn't intentional. But it was, and it was something, it might, I can't remember it, but it was one of, I think it was you being nice, Rachel, bizarrely enough. For a show of face. No, but same, I think, because I've always,
that didn't happen.
Can't have been, it must have been Katie. Might have been, it was about that thing about going, you know, I get really cranky because if every single midwife said, I'm not doing this anymore, it doesn't work, it doesn't make sense, you know, I'm not going to, you know, do good by stealth. I'm going to go, no, you know, that woman is 5 centimeters, but she's doing amazing. I'm not going to do another vaginal examination because it's not necessarily, I'll let you know when the baby's coming or something like that, you know. Then it would change overnight, because it would have to, because then we'd all stop, you know, you know, making up stories to support women, or keeping those doctors outside the door, you know, oh no, you don't need to come in now, you know, and placating them rather than actually standing up for our knowledge and going, no, I know what I'm doing. I will call you if I need you. This woman's fine. She's just going to do whatever she's going to do. And, you know, especially in the hospital, you're in the hospital. Like there are people around. If you need somebody, they're there all the time. Why do they need to intervene all the time? And, you know, they get, well, you know, it's very difficult working in the system because you're going against the grain. And that's right. And that's why I get cranky, because there are the two midwives that get cranky. And people like me, you know, I don't care what you think. I don't care whether you like me or not. You know, I am that person. I mean, of course, I want to be liked. We all want to be liked. But, you know, I'm strong enough in my knowledge and my skills to have that conversation, even though it can be quite confronting. Well, most of the midwives that work in the system aren't. Because they have to go back every single day and they have to work within an environment that doesn't, you know, support them, doesn't trust them, yes, and doesn't, you know, acknowledge that they have these knowledge skills. You know, it's that hierarchy with medicine at the top. And I just think if we all stood together and said no, then maybe it would stop. But and I think.
But that's not going to happen, because oppressed groups oppress each other, and they're, you know, that the solidarity is a long, long way off.
And I think that's what you were saying.
And in terms of that really obvious solidarity.
And also, like, you come out of your course as a new midwife, if you've gone through as a student midwife and you come out, you have this fear of litigation that's put in you at that sort of, I don't know what stage. I can remember the third year talk still that we had about litigation. And I think,
I can,
because the fear of God went into me and I was like, holy shit. And I suppose I'm not playing devil's advocate, but I just feel that it is fear-based, and we're, you know, that's instilled in us. And if you've gone through your training and then all your theory training has been what we're talking about today, and then, of course, we see the juxtaposition, which is your clinical training is the midwife who follows the protocols that are set down by the hospital and set down by the doctors and set down by the other midwife in charge that you have to assess in this way. And then you get the odd midwife who's going to teach you those absolute golden nuggets of watching real progression. But behind it is not only, I think, the fear of I need to fit in because I've got to be here every day and this is my work. And, you know, your work takes up a huge amount of your life and your mental health space. But also, if I leave this woman too long, or if something goes wrong and I haven't assessed her, where do I stand legally? Am I more likely to be in trouble, so to speak, or go to court, or my statement doesn't hold up in court? And that's what goes through my mind is like, does it stand up? Can you use the evidence? Like that, I just, well, then, that's why I'm asking the question, because I haven't.
Part of the problem here, Katie, part of the problem here is that midwives don't understand law. And what you've just described is exactly what happens, is midwives think that they're going to get sued for not doing a thing that's actually just a hospital policy that's not evidence-based. When actually there's the potential for them getting sued for doing the thing that's not evidence-based, because they're accountable by law to a professional standard and to be up to date with evidence and to get consent to do things. So no woman should have a midwife's fingers in her vagina without having been given full information about the inaccuracy, about the risks of doing it, about the discomfort, about how it sets her onto a track that potentially she's probably not going to fit because bodies don't. Because you have to do that before you put your fingers in. So it's interesting that midwives aren't scared of that woman suing her for accidentally breaking her waters and having a cord prolapse during the vaginal examination, or for sending her on a trajectory that results in harm. Women are not suing midwives for that yet. I think it's coming. But midwives are not scared of that. They're not scared of overriding women's rights. They're scared of the rumors and the pretense about getting sued for not doing a thing that's in a guideline, which there's not a lot of evidence for in terms of do midwives get sued.
But there is
that.
A lot of evidence to show that midwives get reported, and that's what hurts the next thing, because that happened to me, because, you know, I didn't, you know, behave the way I was supposed to behave. And I did all sorts of things that, you know, that policy didn't do, you know, didn't support. And I supported women to have births at home, but maybe they didn't, you know, maybe they had a couple of risk factors that, you know, they could have, you know, potentially had some other complications due to those. Even though the women were making informed decisions, even though the documentation was absolute tip top and I followed all the guidelines, I still got reported for dangerous practice or unsafe practice. I mean, this was, you know, quite a while ago, but it's the easiest way to scare everyone because it was the worst thing that ever happened to me because I'm bloody great at my job. And then all of a sudden somebody's told me I'm unsafe. I mean, like, what a blow, you know, and knowing that you're doing research, you know, evidence-based, you're doing all the stuff and women are having these amazing outcomes. And the doctor that, well, it wasn't a doctor that reported me. It was actually a midwife who'd never seen the woman. Under the instruction of the doctor. And she said to one of my colleagues, who is an obstetrician, if you get rid of the midwives, the women have to come to hospital. And at that time, that's exactly what they tried to do. Every time we set foot into the hospital after a transfer or anything like that, we were reported. And it is a really good way to keep people in line.
Yeah.
Because it's really scary, you know, that, you know, you don't want to know, be the naughty girl or, you know, and as professionals, how, you know, how absolutely horrifying to somebody to say that, you know, all those qualifications, all that study you've done, that you're not good, you know, that your practice isn't good. So these are the way that, you know, we do stop people, you know, behaving the way. And it's a warning, which is why people like me, though, are still here saying, but if you're doing the right thing, exactly like Rachel said, you know, you're not being dangerous. Just because you're not, you know, telling this woman she has to do X, Y, and Z, that's not dangerous practice. The woman's making an informed decision to do whatever. And if I choose to support her, you know, how is that unsafe? You know, and when we know the literature shows and actually the figures that free birth is rising all over because women cannot get the support that they want from midwives. Or they can't have access to midwives. So they're not just going to go to hospital. You know, that's not going to be what they're going to choose to do. They're going to do what they can to give birth the way they want to. So we either start trying to support women or, you know, they'll find someone else to do it. But that's a really good way of keeping the midwives in check. You know, don't be like that naughty midwife because, you know, she's rogue or she's a cowgirl or whatever. It's so easy to, you know, keep people in line that way, which it's been going on for generations. You know, you look at looking at the history, it happened when men got you know into birth. That's exactly what happened. You know, the scary old women, you know, they were drunks, they were this, that, and the other, they were dirty because of course they were working class, and they, you know, they were illiterate, a lot of them. They were very skilled, and yes, I'm sure there's always going to be a few dodgy, you know, midwives, doctors, nurses in any profession. There's always going to be some that, you know, probably aren't as good as others. But that's how we got rid of them. And it's easy because we're women. So, and this, you know, this practice of midwifery is, you know, it's witchcraft. It's all the things because it's secret women's business. So I don't even know where we were going with that. And I'd stop ranting now. I should have known better to get me on here. Dr. Ranty Pants the second.
That's the Ranty Pants on.
Dr. Ranty Pants, I love you. For me, as a midwife who's not in that space for a long time, I've been very much postnatal and antenatal and lactation. I still know the fear from myself of being that new midwife. And it was, and I was lucky, I worked with home birth, but from the hospital system, and I worked in a really nice unit, to be honest. But still, I trained in this massive machine with Rachel. I know that fear, not only from myself, but from as a student, from the colleagues, and then that bullying that goes on. And everything you've described. So, and I think we have to acknowledge that's just swimming around us. And the majority of women are going to have to go through that system. They don't have to go through the system. They choose to go through that system. And there isn't enough independent midwives for everybody at this point in time. But there is a question which I'm going to give to Rachel, but I want to ask it if that's all right.
Oh, yeah. Which one's this?
Oh, yeah. And it's the question that probably the midwives who are feeling a bit stuck at that point is, but is there a time point? I should probably read the question. Is there a point when, what did she write? I'm not good at notes. but I know it in my head what I want to
ask.
You
want me to read it, Katie?
Da 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 da. How long's too long? That's what I wanted to ask. I should have just said it. I said, tried to look for the reading.
You know, and this is something that comes up, and I'm not going to say too much because I've got a one at some point I want, because you're going to do as I say, because it's my podcast now and I'm here and I'm going to take over. Sorry, my PhD student, Marina, her research is looking at physiological plateaus during physiological labour. And that's a question. It's really interesting because we have two nurses on our supervision panel. And of course, that's the question. But how long's too long? You know, and we're talking about pauses, yes. Not obviously the length of labour in her research. So I'm not going to go on to that because that's, but it's as long as it is. Like, it's just one of those rubbish answers as well, because too long could be 4 hours. Not long enough could be 3 days. It's not as simple as that. And that's the problem. And that's why it's such a minefield to try and do research in this area and try and get things changed. Because it's, you know, bringing all those skills and that knowledge together to go, well, the woman's, you know, they're doing, I suppose the midwife's doing all this assessing constantly. And she's, you know, she's looking at, you know, is she hydrated? Is she well rested? You know, is the baby in a good position? You know, is she, you know, feeling safe and supported and blah, 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 you know? And then also, of course, we're not even going to get there today, but, you know, you've got your gut instinct as well, which is a whole other kind of conversation. But, you know, and that could be, well, she's just a slow, you know, she's just slowly getting there, or, you know, and that's going to take a while because, you know, it may well be that, you know, she's, you know, not really getting into her rhythm, you know, there's other stuff going on. She's got too much. Again, we're talking about it a lot, don't we? That women that sometimes get really in their head and they can't get into their bodies and, you know, she's not in the zone. So, you know, and it's not that she's not in labor. She's just not in the labor that is going to give her her baby anytime soon. So it doesn't mean that she doesn't necessarily need midwifery support, but, you know, so it's, again, it's that weird understanding of what labor should look like, because it doesn't look like that for all women. So basically I'm waffling on there, but I can't give you that answer. And that's the problem, because everyone wants the time, but 6 hours could be too long. 6 days, which, you know, very rarely women will labor for 6 days, but, you know, you just, it has to be the bigger picture around it. It has to be the building of knowledge, and it has to be more than a vaginal examination, because that's not going to give you that information. And that's the issue. And I'm not saying, you know, that women can labor for 6 days, because we know what that looks like if they haven't, you know, for example, you know, places like Ethiopia, you know, when these young women have been laboring out in, you know, you know, out in the communities, not having access to hospitals and midwives, we know that that, you know, those women were in obstructed labor. I mean, there's lots of other stuff that's attached to that as well. It wasn't just the length of time, but, you know, in our society, when we've got access to hospitals, access to doctors, does it really matter if the woman's, you know, at home for 2 days? If, you know, she's laboring, she's supported, she's well hydrated, she's well. I don't think it does.
And I think that this goes, this isn't just labour stuff, though, that we don't get the nuances anymore. It drives me crazy that is the probably the primary question I get about it. Pretty much everything is, but what's, when is too long? What is too much? What are the parameters? Because we're trained to want to have, I control freak. I like to have numbers. I do. What time's this thing happening? You know, I'm like that as well. So I get it. But people want the concretes, and it, you know, it's bodies. Yeah. We're messy. We're complicated. Bodies don't work like that. And I was thinking recently, thinking about why is it that we struggle to learn nuance, because student midwives often say to me, but how am I going to know when I need to put my hands on a baby? How am I going to know when? And I think partly this is to do with losing the apprenticeship model of training. So in the past, you know, as a new midwife, you would not be out there responsible for births on your own. You would have worked for years and years and years with the local community midwife, and you would have sat through hours of births. She would have said to you, this, recognize that sound, because that's not all right. So I'm going to do something about that. And would have picked that up. So by the time they were the one who was the primary midwife, they would be bringing all of that kind of lived experience of being with women at birth. And students don't have that now. They're taught by textbooks. They're out into a clinical area with often support from other clinicians who haven't seen physiology. And, you know, they're straight off the bat, you're the responsible midwife. Yeah, you're the one who's in charge, in quotes, of this room and of the practice and of what's happening. And I don't know whether you can then learn nuances as easily, you know, without
all of that. You're 100% right. And it makes me think about, you know, when I first went into private practice, I basically had an apprenticeship with a midwife. Of course, I was already a midwife. And it's that unlearning as well, but also exactly like sit down, shut up and watch is basically what I was told to do for pretty much the first year. And just watchful, you know, watch, they call it watchful waiting, but just constantly in tune. And that was one of the things that when you had Ellie on, I was driving and I was listening. And there's all the things that Ellie was saying, how difficult it can be, you know, for those midwives working within the system, because they're in and out different rooms. They've got so much, they're on high alert all the time. So their body is not in tune with the environment. So they can't pick up on those subtleties. So they also relation based care as well. Like they don't know the women they're caring for either. So, you know, there's so many complexities around that, about how we assess women, how we, you know, support women, because we're not being passed the knowledge. We're not understanding the knowledge that's been given to us. And I mean, and I had that recently with a midwife that I was working with who's just come out of the system. And I was watching this woman who was what we would call a quiet achiever. She'd been niggling pretty much all night and she didn't look like she was doing anything if you weren't watching her. And I was watching her and I literally could see that she was just changing her body slightly. That's all she was doing. And the other midwife, because she wasn't used to being so in tune with those subtleties, was literally washing up at the sink, looking out the window because she's not going to have a baby anytime soon. And I watched this woman. I thought, she said she did the whole, I've got to go to the toilet, and got out the pool. And I thought, we're going to have a baby in a minute, because you could see that she was quite private. And I think, you know, she obviously decided at the moment that, you know, she needed to be in a more private space. And then 2 seconds later, you know, the husband's running out going, the baby's coming, because it was quite obvious the baby was going to come. But if you weren't in tuned and you didn't know those nuances, you wouldn't have seen that at all. And I think we've forgotten some of those skills. And going back to what Katie was saying, I don't really know how we can reteach those skills, because I think, yeah, I don't know. I think it actually, this is really depressing, isn't it? Because,
yeah.
Well, women can teach us if we can get ourselves into situations where women can teach us. Because even when I was very experienced when I went out into private practice and with home birth from the UK, but I was new to private practice and I was new actually to just being with where the woman took me, because I was used to working with guidelines and things. And I had huge amounts of unlearning. And I can still remember this woman, first baby, and her contractions were never, they were like 5 minutes apart, 7 minutes apart, like, you know, not in established labor, in quotes. Okay. And she was laboring for best part of 2 days, but very spaced out. So I'm kind of going, oh, this is not an effective labor contraction pattern, because I had never seen a primip do this. You know, the baby can't come out from this. We're going to have to, you know, do the vaginal examination and do the whole talk about transferring to hospital, blah, blah, blah. And I was the second midwife. So luckily I had to keep my mouth shut a bit more than the first midwife. And, you know, just as we're having this conversation downstairs, the two midwives about, I think we need to talk about assessing, and, you know, this has been going on for a while, she starts pushing a baby out. And pushed a baby out, still 5-7 minutes apart in the call. And when we looked at this baby, you know, it was a decent size if you measure the baby, weigh the baby, but he looked like a hungry little growth-restricted baby, and his placenta was crap and his cord was crap. And I don't think he could have managed a full-on, powerful 4-in-10 contraction pattern. So her body was just fitting around what this baby needed, but I'd never seen it. So it was like real humbling to me to see that and go, okay, I actually don't know everything. And there's way more to physiology than I know.
I think that's one of my struggles, is because that's what I see all the time. So it's really hard for me sometimes to try and get other people to understand that. That's why I trust birth so much. Because I also trust it, because it'll tell me when it's not working. So that's the other thing. It's like, you know, I think it was Hannah or somebody said about the ripple in the pond, because all I see is women doing it. that if they're not doing it, it looks really obvious to me. And it's that flip side when all you see is it going horribly wrong or us having to intervene. It's very hard to see the normal. And there's more variance in normal than there is in the abnormal, because the abnormal is quite obvious. Mm. And it's, you know, very, you know, there's certain things that will happen. Whereas with normal, if all you see is this vast, you know, these women just doing it the way they need to do it, for us, it can seem really obvious, which kind of goes back to the how long is too long, because it's so obvious when it's not working, when you're just in tune with the women. And
the woman will tell you. Women will say things like the baby's stuck, there's something wrong.
And also you go, like exactly that. I mean, I just had a text from one of the midwives this morning to say, you know, something's not quite right. She's been niggling for a couple of days. She's not really doing anything. So I've asked her if she wouldn't mind, you know, coming for an assessment or whatever, because the woman's already called it and the midwives called it. You know, she's not in, you know, labor. Mm. If she was in the hospital, they'd probably just send her home, you know, like she's not, but they're going, there's something not quite right here. It's not an emergency, but there's something a little bit off. You know, and sometimes it's not even anything physical. There's the mental stuff, and that's the something we really forget. And I've got a lovely tale like that, Rachel, about a woman that looked like she wasn't doing it. And it's one of those things sometimes I think, now how clever we are. I did shared care with this woman, and I don't know why I wanted to do shared care. And it's only on reflection when you go, that's why I had, you know, the midwife there the whole time. It's an amazing woman, first baby. And we'd been back and forth to that house over like 3 days. And she'd look, you get there and she'd look like she was doing it. And then everything would kind of stop. And then we'd go home and then we'd go back. And then this last night, she really looked like she was cracking on. Then everything just stopped. And I thought, you know what, I'm going to do a vaginal examination. Because by this time I thought, we need to know what's going on here. 3 days, you know, back and forth. She was fine. Baby's was fine. But like, we've got to have a baby sometime, you know. And so I said, look, you know, we need to figure out, you know, is the baby in a crap position? You know, what's going on here, you know? So can I do a vaginal examination to get more information? Yeah, you can do it. I did a vaginal examination. The baby's head was literally not far away at all, you know, and she was fully dilated. And I just thought, that can't be right. Like she doesn't even look like she's in labor. She's literally... She was opening the fridge, eating spaghetti bolognese 5 minutes ago and dancing and being silly. She's like, I just like what? So I literally said to the other midwife, can you check my vaginal examination? So she rolls her eyes at me like, are you joking? And I'm like, do you mind? So because my face is like, so, and I'm like, everything's okay. But anyway, then she stuck her fingers in and went, she's fully, the baby's right there. And I was like, yeah, no contractions. So I just said to her like, I don't understand. Like, the, you know, obviously it wasn't a big baby. Like, what's going on here? Off she goes into the toilet with her partner and stuff. I'm in the chat. You know, we pull it all out. And I go in and I said, okay, what's going on? I have got no tricks left. Like, we either, you know, like, the baby has to come out at some point. He's fine. You're fine. But, like, what's going on? Massive cry. I'm just not ready not to be pregnant anymore. And I remember grabbing her hands and go, but I'm ready. I need these babies to be born. I'm really tired. She pissed herself laughing. She literally got off that toilet, went into the bathroom, grabbed hold of it and threw a baby out. Literally a couple of pushes and the baby came out. Like, he nearly fainted because he was just like, what the hell? And it was like, she just wasn't ready. That baby should have come out probably a few hours before, and she just didn't want to be not pregnant anymore. She wasn't ready to be a mum. Like, that would never have happened in hospital. You know, that would have, you know, she would have, I look back at these kind of births and go, the woman would have ended up in the system. She probably would have had either augmentation or, you know, who knows what could have happened to her. It was hilarious. And it's one of those stories that you tell. And then, of course, she went on to have more baby, another baby with us, and, you know, totally celebrates herself because how amazing is she? You know, we've got a video of her literally just before we did the VA in a dressing gown and a, you know, her UGG boots, eating the spaghetti bolognese and dancing, you know, trying to get her contractions going. Like, literally had a baby not long after. But these are like, we've all got these stories, but we don't allow these stories to happen anymore because we just don't trust the women.
It just feels like, it feels really sad at this point. It's like,
you want us to do a song for you to cheer you up?
Yeah. I need a song because it's so beautiful to hear these stories and then And then you just think, oh God, it's so hard to work where we can't see that, or you've been lucky enough to be taught those, but the system doesn't allow you to practice like that anymore or at all, or it's so hard for you to try and do it, or you're doing it subversely, you know, undercover, so to speak, with your colleagues. I mean, that's...
But then these stories need to be told. It's a bit like women not telling their good birth stories, and because they're scared of the impact it'll have on other women who don't have good birth stories, because, you know, a lot of women are traumatized during birth. So then you hear women who had positive, empowering birth stories scared to talk about them. But we actually need those stories out there to show there is another way of doing this, to give hope that, you know, there is another way of doing this, that you're right when you're looking at it and going, this isn't right, that, you know, you're validated in that. Absolutely, it's not right.
And I think that's another thing, and again, why Rachel needs to do the research with me in that half a day a week that you're going to give me for an analysis. But, you know, one, doing research that, you know, it's really hard when you're doing midwifery research, right? Because the kind of research that we want to do, the storytelling, the, you know, that other ways of knowing, it doesn't bring the big bucks in. You know, nobody's going to give you a research fund to do that, because it's, you know, even though they absolutely should, because when you look at the money that's spent on the women, you know, that with never mind having, you know, cesareans that aren't necessary, but also the birth trauma and the mental health issues that women are suffering from because of the way they're treated during birth. So they should be throwing money at us to try and, you know, find a way to, you know, make a different way. So if anybody's out there listening, can you give us some money to do this research? Because, you know, it is so important to do this kind of stuff and get it out there, because, like we say, women know and midwives know. And the more we hear it, the more confident, you know, women and midwives will get. So I do think there is a place for that, you know. And, you know, me, I'm a nobody, but, you know, one, I'm talking to you guys, and also I am, you know, teaching students now, and I, you know, I'm out there. Like, I look, when I, you know, when I first started working as a privately practicing midwife in WA, it was kind of, you know, the naughty midwives. We weren't, but, you know, we were thought of as the naughty midwives. Now it's becoming more of a mainstream option. I mean, there's still lots of challenges, but we're getting the admitting rights to hospital. We're getting on, you know, we're getting listened to. I'm not scared of going into the hospital anymore. Like, I would always go to the hospital, but, you know, I used to be scared that if I went in and they didn't like what I'd done or what I said, that I would be reported. Now I'm not scared of that anymore, because I know, like you say, they might not like me, but I'm generally well respected and I'm listened to, and I have some power back. So when you see this out there and you see people like me, you know, the naughty midwife with a PhD now on the, you know, boards, on academic, you know, whatever, all the other stuff that we do. But, you know, you can see that, you know, maybe we're not that crazy. Maybe there is other ways that we need to listen to, and, you know. And like I say, the midwives are coming, because they are seeing that different model, because the more midwives there are practicing like this, the more, like exactly like you were saying, Katie, the students get to work with midwives like us. Like, I always have, if the woman is open to it, I try and have a student with every birth that I attend now, because they just learn so much. You know, I have a student that says to me, she's learned more for me. She's been to 3 births with me, and, you know, blew her mind, some of the stuff. Like, and one of the women, we had a hospital birth, 37 weeks, preeclampsia, you know, and but still had amazing relationship-based care, you know, was complex, but still saw a different way of doing it. And then, you know, she's been to home births and just seen, you know, the information, the way it's shared. And so it's not even just about the birth, it's about the whole thing. So, you know, the more midwives that practice like this, you know, the more students get, and then they can see the other way as well. So I think there is hope. And I think that's where I was trying to get there, that, you know, we have to, you know, well, one, what are we going to do? We're going to stop doing it. Women are going to keep having babies. You know, I've got a daughter. I want her to have a great birth. I want her to start her parenting. If she chooses to have children, I want her to feel amazing after her birth. I don't want her to be broken. So, you know, it gives us that incentive to, you know, keep battling on. And it's, the other thing is, it's, you know, it's an age old battle. You know, it's been going on a really long time. So as much as we're in this place and we go, it's really hard, it's very depressing, well, they're not burning us at the stake at the moment. So that's, you know, that's got to be a plus.
That's your positive.
Our positive ending. Wow. We're not setting us on fire anymore.
That's so how far. We end.
But that's better than a song. I can't think of a song, so that'll have to do.
Burn, baby, burn. Sorry, that's really inappropriate.
You can't say I'm dancing because I don't sing, but I'm like I have a dance.
That is one of my favourite ever films.
What?
Saturday Night Fever.
Is that where it's from?
Is that from that?
No. I think it is.
Yeah.
Burn, baby, burn.
Yeah.
Is it?
Yes, it is.
Disco Inferno.
Disco Inferno.
Is that from that?
I thought it was like
Staying alive.
Oh God, both of them. Both those songs.
Yeah, Saturday Night Fever.
Burn, baby, and then Staying Alive. Oh, so we've gone from ancient history to what we are now. Oh, it's a bit... It's a little on the nose.
There you go. But, and we had a sing along and a dance. So there you go. All right. Have I answered all your questions then appropriately, or have I just ranted on like a crazy woman for an hour?
No, done brilliant. Brilliant. Rachel, do you want to ask?
You've answered the questions while ranting on like a crazy woman. So
well,
that's
you're
perfect.
Used to it, aren't you? So, nothing new there.
I am.
Exactly. We choose our guests wisely.
Bring your own ranty pants.
Well, I think that that is a bloody marvellous place to bring us to a close. And I want to say a huge thank you to coming and joining us in the cauldron. It has been marvellous, insightful, upsetting, truthful, and also some dancing and some singing along the way, which is what keeps us going. Thank you so much, Claire. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
We hope you found this episode insightful, intriguing, and enjoyable. Please get onto your socials, start sharing, and pop on over to leave us a review and a comment. Because you know what I'm going to say. This is what gets more people listening. And more people listening means more positive change. And that's what we all want, ain't it? You can find Dr. Claire over at Instagram at midwife.dr.claire and on Twitter at sagefemclaire. All details are in the show notes as always. If you haven't already, pop on over to mine and Rachel's websites. I'm still fine-tuning at this stage. Who knew creating a whole website and courses with tons of interesting content could take as long as this? So sign up to my mailing list. I definitely don't spam. I haven't got the time. And that way, you'll hear first when my new course, Breastfeeding and Lactation, The Fundamentals, is released for your listening ear holes and your peeping eyeballs. This is the course for you if you have ever felt you needed that extra bit of help with your breastfeeding knowledge in order to provide good support to those in your care. Rachel is already in full flow with not one, my friends, but two online courses, as well as her awesome collective. Be sure to check this out. I wanted to say a huge thank you to you guys for sharing us with your friends on socials and on Apple Podcast reviews. The podcast is growing really well, and I'm delighted, to be honest. Thank you. But I do want to ask another favour from you. You know me, I'm super cheeky. Rachel and I have agreed to not take sponsorship or money for this podcast. So despite the very impressive monthly downloads, which attract many companies who want to sponsor us, we have chosen not to take it. However, creation and organisation of this content takes a lot of work. And in order to bring it to you every 2 weeks, I need your support. However small, it keeps this ball rolling and enables me to bring this to you. You can find the links to our Patreon and the Buy Me a Coffee in the show notes below or on our Instagram bio. If you have found the content we've provided helpful, if you've used this content to educate others, if you've used the podcast for continuous professional development points, please consider a one-off or monthly donation. So thank you. So all I've got to say now is, see you next time. And here's the many bloopers.
We're recording, Reed.
Hi, Reedy.
Dog's fine. If you need it, I'll come and get you. She'll come and get you. Sorry, the dog's asleep under my desk.
Well, there could be puppy antics later if we get overexcited then, couldn't there?
Yeah. Poop Nugget comes onto the show. Sorry, Esther.
She'll always be poopy in my eyes, I'm yeah. Sorry.
Yeah, totally. What's this Esther name? I mean,
you're so mean.
You've got a dog that looked all brown and cute and fluffy. Anyway, I'm not going to go and tell my poos look because they're definitely not cute and fluffy.
Straight into the poo talk.
Yeah, that's it. I'm awake. Let's get it out.
I didn't start it.
Oh, God. Okay, right.
Have you got no clothes on, Rachel, pretty much? Is it hot?
I have got clothes on.
That's how she starts.
But it is hot and it's humid.
It's freezing here at the moment.
It's really humid and hot and disgusting. And I'm going to turn the fan off in case it's making a noise.
Good job she has got something on because she's just stood up.
I guess I thought I should be showing her bottom.
Yeah, we'd have a bit of bottom cam. I would have definitely screenshotted that. Oh my God.
Well, I have to have bottoms on, otherwise my bum sticks to the chair.
That's not a nice thought.
Lovely. Thank you for that. I haven't had any breakfast yet. And get a gin. Come back.
Hopefully it's a good start for the day, Kate.
This is never tea. It's never tea, just a mug.
So you sound so happy on the podcast, isn't it?
Exactly. I couldn't do it any other way. Bloody hell, I need my gin. Wondering which of my courses is for you? Breastfeeding and Lactation, the Fundamentals has been designed for everyone working in the birthing field or those on their journey to becoming breastfeeding specialists or IBCLCs. This course gives you 7 hours of CPD and is packed with reflective learning, case studies and some pretty tough, at times, quizzes to make sure this stuff sticks. It also means you can meet me monthly in my live Q&A. This is my course that I hope will fill in the gaps that traditional breastfeeding education has left out. I want you completing this, feeling confident to support any breastfeeding or lactation challenge of those in your care. But wait, I have another course called The Feeding Couch. Who's this for? Currently, around 80 to 96% of women decide to breastfeed during their pregnancy, but by just 8 weeks after birth, a third to almost 50% of those women have stopped breastfeeding. And of those women who stopped, 80% say they stopped breastfeeding before they wanted to. Learning about breastfeeding during pregnancy has been shown to improve breastfeeding self-confidence and improve the rate of exclusive breastfeeding in the short and the long term. I believe every mum should be able to choose how she wants to feed her baby and for how long. Knowledge is power. That's why I created The Feeding Couch, designed to be watched during pregnancy or for new mums and parents who may be struggling right now with breastfeeding. The content is in step-by-step, binge-worthy whilst pregnant or for those most tired of days postpartum, totally easy to find exactly what you need and dip in and out when you need a breastfeeding answer quickly. And for you, beautiful podcast listener, there is a 10% discount off both courses when you use the code POD10, that's P-O-D-10, at checkout. To find out more, hop on over to my website, katiejames.site, and have a look at the incredible content waiting for your lucky peepers.